And we're in 1 Kings chapter 18, and we left off last week in this section beginning in verse 17, at the time when Elijah the prophet meets with Ahab, king of Israel. So this is a very important meeting because this is at the now at the end of this 3.5 years of famine. The last record we have of Elijah speaking to Ahab is when we were introduced to Elijah back in verse 1 of chapter 17, when he informed Ahab that there would be neither rain nor dew on the earth except at Elijah's word. So Elijah was telling him there was now going to be a famine. And of course, the reason for the famine was because of the wickedness of Israel. And we've gone back and looked at the scriptures where God had promised that he would bring famine upon the people if they forsook him. Now, would it have been his will to bring a famine on all of Israel if Ahab, the king, and his wife Jezebel, if they had forsaken the Lord and followed Balaam, but the rest of the nation had remained steadfast with the Lord and had continued to serve him, and if it was just a matter of the king himself alone being wicked with his wife, would he have brought a famine on all the land for that? No. That was a promised punishment for the people, for the nation, if they as a nation had forsaken the Lord and not followed him. So what do we know happened, though, with Ahab and with Jezebel? Well, the nation had already turned away from the Lord, going back to the time of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, when the kingdom was first divided. And there had been righteous ones that were there in the nation, though they were not a majority, even though we do know that the turning away from God that occurred among the tribes of Israel started before Jeroboam and the split of the kingdom. Jeroboam was part of the result of that turning away, and then he was a cause of further turning away. But God had promised through his prophet that he was going to divide the kingdom as punishment for Solomon's idolatry. But again, he would not have split the kingdom if it had just been the king who had had that problem. But, you know, going back to what we had studied before in 1 Kings chapter 11, God stated that Israel, the people of Israel, had also turned to idols at the time that Solomon had. So that was the worst part of, or one of the worst parts of what happened to Solomon when he had his heart turned away from the Lord to idols for that period of time, which we know he repented from. But when you turn to wickedness, and how often is it that someone's choice, wrong choices, end up influencing others in a wrong direction? I mean, that's a very common thing. It's rare when somebody does something or chooses a pathway of evil, and if they forsake the Lord, that they're not also going to negatively impact and do harm to other people, very potentially lead them astray as well, especially a leader like we saw with the king in Solomon's case, and that happened. And so many of the people turned to idols, and that was the reason that God divided the kingdom. And then he gave them Jeroboam. I mean, were they worthy of a man like Jeroboam, the son of Nebat? Well, obviously they were. That's what God gave them. But would God have given them a man like that if the people had been seeking the Lord like they should? Or was that part of God's punishment? And then he used that influence of Jeroboam there was the choice for the people again to determine whether or not they would go back to the Lord as Solomon had repented, or were they going to go deeper into wickedness with a man like Jeroboam as their king, which they did. Well, that just, that downhill, that spiritual downhill decline in Israel continued, and then it reached a low point under Omri, who was Ahab's father. But then Ahab, and we know that there were statutes of Omri, as we saw and mentioned in the prophets, that he made other laws that hindered the people from obeying the Lord. And so when Jeroboam first became king, the ones that were righteous that were in the kingdom then, they moved south to Judah, joined themselves to Rehoboam, who was following the Lord at the time, and they could serve the Lord there. Well, during Omri's time, we know that there were still some people that left Israel and went to Judah then. So it was a very low time. Well, that's the climate. And then when Ahab becomes king, and then we know he married Jezebel, who was a Baal worshiper, and converted her husband to that, and then established that as the religion for the kingdom. And so it's gotten worse and worse. And so it's in this situation then where it was God's will, and Elijah prayed for the Lord to bring a famine upon Israel because of all of this. And the Lord heard the prayer and did it, because it was the right thing to do in fulfillment of God's promises as part of his punishment for their wickedness. But we also looked at a number of scriptures when God would do this. It was not just punishment for its own sake, but it was punishment with a design. And what was one of the goals that God would have through such punishments? Like we saw many times in the history of the judges, one of the other curses when they would turn away from the Lord was that God would bring their enemies against them to oppress them. And in that cycle through the judges, every time a judge would be raised up and deliver them from one of those enemies, then after the time of that judge, the next generation would turn away from the Lord, he'd raise up another enemy, and they would oppress them, and then what would end up happening eventually after some period of time? That's when they would turn back to God, and he would raise up another judge to deliver them. And that cycle went, repeated itself over and over again through the history of the judges. So with those curses that he brought on Israel as punishments, whether it was oppression by their enemies and defeat at their hands, or by famine in this case, what was God doing other than just punishing? It was punishment with what design? Yes, and now, is this going to work? And it does, and it's going to work right here in this part of 1 Kings 18 that we're looking at. It's not going to work with Ahab himself or with Jezebel. They're not going to be converted back to the Lord. But the purpose of this meeting between Elijah and Ahab was to set up the occasion, the situation that would lead to the repentance of many of the people of Israel and their rejection of Baal and their acknowledgement that Jehovah is God. And that's what's going to happen in this chapter. So he needs Ahab to do it, though. So he has to meet with Ahab to get Ahab to call all the people to Carmel. I mean, if Elijah had just sent out a proclamation and said, everybody gather at Mount Carmel, would Israel have gathered there? That wouldn't have happened. He needed Ahab, the king, to call all the people there. So when he presented himself to Ahab in verse 17, Ahab speaks those words, are you he that troubles Israel? What's the answer to that question? I mean, now, is that a question where he's seeking information, or is that a question where he's making an accusation with the question? Yeah, he's making an accusation. But just to answer the question, what is the answer? No. And that's actually what Elijah says in verse 18. I've not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house. So he identifies who the problem was. Ahab's blaming Elijah because Elijah told him there's going to be a famine and my word, and it won't be lifted until I pray to God for it to be lifted. So then Ahab's blaming him for it. Well, why would God hear Elijah's prayer for that? I mean, mean, as we mentioned, Elijah could not have brought this famine by his own power. This was God's work. So how could it be Elijah's fault? Why did God hear his prayer? Why was it God's will for there to be a famine in Israel? It wasn't because Elijah was evil. God wouldn't have heard his prayer if he had not been. This was the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man, as we're told in James 5:16. Well, it was because of Ahab and Jezebel and the evil that they had done, which is what Elijah mentioned in verse 18, that they had forsaken the commandments of the Lord and had followed Balaam. And so in verse 19, Elijah then said, "Now therefore gather all Israel to Mount Carmel," and not just the people of Israel. Of course, Elijah's going to be there. Elijah as God's prophet, but he also said that those prophets of Baal, the 450, and the 400 prophets of the groves that eat at Jezebel's table, were also to be gathered there. So it's going to be a showdown, and it's going to reveal who the true God is and who his prophet is and who is speaking his word. And so everybody is gathered together at Mount Carmel from verse 20. Ahab sent to all the children of Israel and did that. And so starting in verse 21 now, we're going to read about what happens and how God is going to bring the end of the famine, but by bringing Israel to a change of their minds. So let's start reading here in verse 21 and down through 24, 1 Kings 18, 21 through 24. Brother Glenn, can you read that, please? Okay, so in verse 20 or 21, all the people are gathered there at Mount Carmel. And by the way, if we can just do our little looks bad with that one. Okay, our little map of Israel. You know, we make this map. There's that little notch up here on the Mediterranean coast in Israel. And it's right in this area that today the city of Haifa. Jan, have you been there? Did you? So Jan's been there. Then that means you've seen Mount Carmel, because Mount Carmel is right there. Haifa, which is the third largest city in Israel today, the Israel, not the Bible Israel, the one that's called Israel today. Jerusalem and Tel Aviv are their biggest cities. Haifa is the third biggest city today in that area. And it's built on the slopes of that Mount Carmel, which is about 1,700 feet high. And it's, at least from pictures, it looks pretty prominent. Jan has seen it with his own eyes. I mean, it stands out. It's what? Oh, is that right? Okay, so, but it's in, I mean, it's in the area, it's a very prominent area, and it's in northern Israel. I mean, it would be in the territory that was under Ahab's rule, not part of Judah. So this would be a very prominent location to gather the people together. So that's where this happens. So no hotel back then, but at any rate, they gather there. That's the location for this. And so he asked the people a question, and this is the central question that's at the root of the problem. He says, how long halt you between two opinions? Now that word halt, that Hebrew word there, literally means to hop. Hopping back and forth. The word opinion there, in English, our word opinion, I'm not going to criticize the translation here. Literally, it means a division, like a division in mind. And that was the case. I mean, there are two different divisions of thought at this point, that Jehovah's God and that Baal is God. And a lot of the people, well, they've accepted Baal, but how many of them are accepting, well, Baal is God, but Jehovah's a God as well? I mean, there's some of that thinking. I know I've mentioned it before. I'm sure Caleb has seen this, as well as others that are by number that have had opportunity to visit on the other side of the world to India. But you can go into different shops and things there, and a lot of them, most of that, the predominant religion there is Hinduism. But a lot of the shopkeepers, they'll have their particular, the Hindu deities that they are particularly following, and sometimes you'll smell incense. They'll have some burning incense because they want to do good business and they think that that's going to help. But they'll have pictures a lot of times. You'll see it on the shop wall with some of the different Hindu deities in the pictures. But in the middle of that, a lot of times you'll see a picture that's supposed to be Jesus. That's just one of, you've seen that, haven't you? And it's like, there'll be Ganesh and some of these other ones, and then supposedly Jesus as one of among these different ones. And so there's several, there lots of those that they'll just accept, well, Jesus is a God in their thinking. And they just add him to whatever else they're worshiping. And, that sort of thing was around in Israel at this time. And so they did some hopping around. Well, yeah, Jehovah, he's God, but so is Baal. But is that acceptable? We're going to see more of this later when this northern kingdom, they never do fully get out of the hopping around problem, even though in this case they're going to acknowledge Baal's not God, Jehovah is. But this isn't going to be something that keeps that this all these tribes that gets them on the right path where they're going to follow God forever. It's going to bring an end to the famine, but this is going to be an issue for this kingdom through the rest of its duration. They're not going to have any righteous kings that serve Jehovah. And eventually Assyria comes and conquers the land and takes them into captivity. Then they bring in people from other lands, Sepharvaim and some of the other kingdoms that the Assyrians had conquered. And they brought their remnant and put people into Israel to settle that area, especially in this area where Samaria had been the capital. And these are the people that eventually became known as the Samaritans. But their ethnic background was mixed of different nations that the Assyrians had conquered. And their religious background was of idolatry of those nations. And when they were settled into Israel by the Assyrians, immediately, and this is what we read in 2 Kings chapter 18, which we're not going to go there now, but you can 2 Kings 17 and 18, you can just make a note of that. But when they first went in there, they had all kinds of problems and plagues and whatnot. So they decided they needed to find out the customs of the God of the land. And so they got one of those priests from Israel. Well, what kind of priest did they have in the northern kingdom? Those ones that Jeroboam appointed, these weren't godly men, but they taught them to add Jehovah to whatever else they were doing, and so that's what they did. And so they made Jehovah worship, they incorporated that into the rest of their idolatrous practices. So it's another example of this. So we have a lot of cases that we can look at, even from the Bible times, where worship of God was added to worship of other beings. But is that acceptable? No. What was the first of the Ten Commandments? He's the only one. That was commandment number one. And then number two was very, To love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength is the first and greatest commandment. Isn't having no other gods before me it's a facet of that, of course. And that's why all those commandments hang upon that, number one, and then loving your neighbor as yourself. But commandment number two, not to make unto themselves any graven images. I mean, that hung on that commandment too, didn't it? So having these other idols and having graven images, this was not acceptable to God. He forbade that. God is the only God, and He is the only one that is to be worshipped and served, not as one among many, or one among two, or one among any other number. He alone is God. And that's going to be the lesson of 1 Kings chapter 18. So Elijah points out that problem. Here are two divisions, where Jehovah is God or is Baal. And it's time to stop hopping back and forth or hopping around on that question. Now, when we, in English, the word opinion, when we use that word, it's a little problematic if we think of this in terms of opinion. Because we have blue carpet in here. I mean, that's reflective of, I guess, our collective opinion that was the best, that we agreed that was going to be the best color for our carpet. And I hope I'm not stirring something up here. But at any rate, is it possible somebody's opinion might be that some shade of red would be better? Again, I'm not trying to invite an issue to arise, but that sort of thing, we can have opinions about something like that. Well, when it comes to an actual opinion, is one opinion better than another's other than mine? That's kind of how we think of it. Our opinion is right, everybody else's is wrong. But truly, in something that we categorize as an opinion, I mean, I may have my opinion about something, and you have your opinion about something. But, I mean, if truly in matters of opinion, is one better than another? So this really isn't two, even though we've had the word here, this isn't two opinions. Well, my opinion is Jehovah is God, and the other's opinion is Baal is God, and either or is okay. It's not. Yes, and that's exactly right. This is, Jehovah is God, or he's not. I mean, that's the central question. Of course, he is the right answer. So they need to stop this division of thinking on this question and recognize and acknowledge that Jehovah, the self-existent one, the eternal one, is the creator of all things, is the only true and living God, the God of heaven, the God of all. And to acknowledge that and reject that there can be any other God. So this is not an actual a question of opinion. It's a question of what is right, what is true on this. And it's the most important question that there is. What more important question is there than about who our Maker is and who we're supposed to seek and serve? I mean, that's it. And everything else, any other issue, is going to be a subsidiary of that, is going to be related to that. If we have the right answer to that question, and then we follow suit from there, then every other question that we would have is going to be answered in light of that. And then if we have the right answer about that question, then we'll have the right answer about all the other ones. This was the basic question that needed to be settled here in Israel at the time. Did the people dispute that, or what did they have to say about that? Not a word in verse 21. They did not answer a word. What is the natural secondary question to that? Well, how long are you going to be divided? Make a decision. Who is God here? Well, upon what basis? So the next question is, well, how is that going to be settled? And so that's what Elijah answers there. So he said to the people, he says, I, even I only, remain a prophet of the Lord, and he's using the word Yahweh again there for Jehovah. Were there any other prophets of Jehovah around in his time? We already know there were from this very chapter, because that man Obadiah, who was Ahab's governor, had hid 100 of them by 50 in caves and were providing food and water. But how many prophets of Jehovah were able to walk openly in this kingdom at this time, preaching his word? They couldn't, because the penalty was death. That's why those ones had to be hidden. So right now, as far as at this point in time, openly in this situation, representing Jehovah is Elijah as his prophet, as the one speaking his word, and there is no other there on that side. I mean, this, think about Elijah's position here. I mean, he's called the whole nation together, this whole kingdom of 10 tribes of Israel, to be gathered here on this question about who is God, and he is the sole one standing up for the true God of heaven and to speak his word. And he's identifying that as the case. And he says, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. So here's one on one side, and you got 450 on the other. So if right and wrong is determined by numbers of followers, then who wins here?
Obviously Baal.
Is there thought today that that numbers determine what is right and wrong, and whether what God says is right or not? Well, nobody thinks this anymore. Everybody thinks this way now. And there are a lot of fundamental questions of morality, issues of morality, that even just within most of our lifetimes, just about everybody in here within our lifetimes, we know it wasn't that long ago when on many things, who would have stood up for some of the blatantly wicked forms of behavior that are being stood up for now? I mean, if somebody had told me, I don't know, 30 years ago, some of the stuff that would be, this is what would be the generally accepted positions on various things within this short period of time, I don't know that I would have believed it. And maybe you feel the same way, but what's happened? But now, I mean, we're being hammered because of the numbers now, because, you know, there's so much, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's in true numbers, but as far as the numbers of who's got the voice, I mean, we're dealing with a different situation nowadays than we were a few years ago, and the weight of numbers or as control of whether it's media or whatever else, I mean, that has a lot to do with the pressure that we're under about things. But do numbers matter about determining what's right and wrong and what's true or not? Not today any more than this time. Here was Elijah by himself standing up for the truth. You had the king, the queen. You had all of these different prophets of this other so-called God, and the mass following that had ensued as a result of it. If this were determined by numbers, I mean, then this is already over. But truth is not determined by numbers. It never has been. If that were the case, what would have happened in Genesis 6? I mean, what were the numbers? How did the numbers line up then? You had 8 on God's side and the entire world on the other. Well, did that make Noah wrong? Did not. In fact, that had much to do, that made it worse, actually, as far from God's perspective, I mean, God's not going to change his mind or be swayed by the numbers of people who are standing up against him. That made him angrier. I mean, look at Lot's time. What was the view of morality in Sodom and Gomorrah, those cities of the plain in his day? And, I mean, you had Lot. I mean, did Lot even really have his wife with him as far as... as far as where her heart was. Physically, she left with him, but she didn't even make it all the way because where was her heart? I mean, why did she turn back? I mean, it doesn't say in Genesis 19 that she turned back because, but it's very obvious, and especially when Jesus gives those one of the shortest verses in the Bible, Luke 17, when he said, remember Lot's wife. When he's teaching about not turning back, well, it wasn't just that, I wonder what fire coming down and consuming a city looks like. It wasn't just that. Why did they live there in the first place? I mean, there was an obvious love of the world that was in her that was the problem. So, I mean, you had Lot. He had other children, and when he was saying, you got to get out of here, the ones they were grown and married, what did they say?
They refused.
They were a part of it at that time. So he had the two young daughters that went out with him. They were the only ones that survived, but they weren't righteous either. They became the mothers of those nations of Moab and Ammon. So it's really sad. I mean, in actuality, as far as righteousness that was in all those cities, how many were there really? One man, Lot. So if numbers determined what was right and wrong, then who was wrong? Then Lot would be wrong. But we know that's not the case. And there are lots of other examples of that. So, in our time, we need to remember that, because no matter how bad it gets, no matter how many people line up, you know, as he tells us in Romans 3 and verse 4, let God be true and every man a liar. Even if you line up everybody against God, they're liars. God is always right. He's always true. So if it comes down to it and all that's left is following him is what's in this room, then so be it. May we never turn. Brother Yon. Exactly right, and that's what the devil's going to do if he can do it. And he was very successful in Israel during these years. And now there are other people we're going to learn about that were following Jehovah. Well, Obadiah is one we learned about, who was Ahab's governor. But how many were there? We'll learn about that few thousand coming up soon. But how many of them could openly stand up and say what they thought and what they believe and confess that? So it's sad what had happened there, and we can see echoes of it, as we mentioned, as Brother Jan is also pointing out. And I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. We need to pray. And I'm very glad that one of our meetings goes by without our prayers mentioning, including for our authorities, as the Lord directs us to. We need to do that. We need to pray for those that are in authority, that we may live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty. You know, we've been able to do that historically in this country, and at least on paper in the Constitution of this country, that should have been the case. But, I mean, how strong is the paper? And, I mean, the strength is in God, not the paper. So we need to ask him to continue to bless us with that. change. There's already been a lot of changes, and but we can't ever change from believing what is true and right. So here's Elijah, and he hadn't changed what he believed, and even when he's by himself here in this situation. So verse 23, he says, "Let them therefore give us two bullocks, and let them choose one bullock for themselves, cut it in pieces and lay it on wood, and put no fire under." He says, "And I'll dress the other bullock and lay it on wood and put no fire under, and call you on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of the Lord." There again, he uses the word Yahweh, Jehovah. "And the God that answers by fire, let him be God." And all the people answered and said, "It is well spoken." So they were silent at first, but then when they hear the proposal, here's how this is going to be settled. They agree to it. This is going to... So Elijah is saying, let a miracle be done. The God, whoever is the true God, is going to be able to answer, is going to declare himself and show himself and bear witness to his prophet, or prophets, if it's the other, by this miracle of sending fire down to consume the sacrifice on the respective altar. Well, is that a fair and a good or proper way to determine this? Yes. Because this would be a miracle. I mean, what man can make fire come down from the sky and target it onto a sacrifice on an altar and burn it up? I mean, no man could do that. I mean, that's something only God could do. So he's proposed something that only God could possibly do to declare who God is and who is the one speaking his word there. And they all recognize that would settle it. That would accurately settle it. A miracle, an actual miracle in front of them all. So this is not something that could be in any way argued that, well, that's not a legitimate or very clear way of declaring whether this one is God or the other one. I mean, this is an absolute miracle that's going to settle it. So they agree to it. So who gets to go first? All right, well, he's giving, he's going to, Elijah's going to let the prophets of Baal go first. So that's what happens in starting in verse 25. Let's read from there down through verse 29. 25 through 29. Let's see, Brother Allen, can you read that from 1 Kings chapter 18, 25 through 29?
"And Elijah said unto the prophets of Baal, choose you one bullock for yourselves and dress it first, for you are many. Call on the name of your gods and put no fire on it. They took the bullock which was given them, and they dressed it and called on the name of Baal from morning even until noon, saying, O Baal, hear us. But there was no voice, nor any that answered. And they leaped upon the altar which was made. And it came to pass at noon that Elijah mocked him and said, Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is talking, or he is pursuing, or he is in a journey. Peradventure he sleepeth, and let be awake. And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their manner with knives and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And it came to pass, when midday was past, and they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, that there was neither voice nor any to answer, nor any that departed."
All right, so Baal's prophets put their bullock on their altar, and they start, and this is in the morning time, and they start calling to Baal to hear them, but there's no answer. And then they're leaping on the altar. And so this goes on how long? From morning until the evening sacrifice. They spent all day. He gave them all day. I mean, are they going to be saying, well, you just didn't give us enough time for him to answer. You rushed us. You put us in too big a hurry here. No, he gave them all day long, from morning all the way to evening. So they go through this. They're calling out them all day. They're jumping on the altar. They cut themselves. I mean, they had to, so by their customs, they would do that, shed their own blood. That was going to have a greater effect, a greater appeal to Baal. I mean, this is sick. But, I mean, this is what case study in how foolish people can be. Just this is this is a good one. But while all this is going on, he gave them all morning, gave them all the way to the evening. But when it got to be noontime, then Elijah started mocking him. He's saying, "Cry aloud!" So you need to cry louder. Why? So either he's talking or pursuing or on the journey, or maybe he's asleep and needs to be waked up. So I mean, he's letting him have it now. And that's when they start cutting themselves and bleeding all over the place, and it still has no effect. Do you imagine they were pretty furious just hearing all the mockery coming from Elijah then? But he's exposing, I mean, was Elijah being mean to do that? He's exposing the foolishness of this. I mean, he's exposing how Balaam is not a god. If he's a real god, then he's going to be able to hear. He's not going to be asleep where he can't hear their voice because of that. He's not going to be able to, he's not going to not hear them because he's gone on a journey somewhere, because he's in a conversation with somebody else. The true God of heaven is going to be able to hear no matter what. So he's using those particular words to expose before all the people the foolishness of what's going on here. I mean, by extension, when he's mocking this with what their prophets are doing, I mean, how many of the people that are there at this time have been accepting this Baal as God and these prophets as being actual prophets of Baal? So he's doing this. I mean, it's not just for the sake of he's having enjoying himself at the expense of these false prophets. He's making a point for the sake of the people so they can recognize the foolishness of what they've been believing and following and doing. And it's going to be a great contrast to what's coming next, because when they're finished and there was no voice to answer nor any that regarded, so sufficient time has passed now. They've been given all day. Now Elijah, how much time was he going to require? Very, very little. Just enough time to set the altar up and get the sacrifice there. I mean, he wasn't going to take any time. Just the time for him to pray and ask God to do it, and it was going to be over. So, I mean, there was a reason he let them go first and gave them all day to do it. I mean, and are they protesting about the time? Do they recognize that there's been sufficient time, having been given all day long, for them to have Baal answer by fire if he were going to do so? And why didn't he? Because who is he? I mean, he's a figment of man's imagination. He doesn't exist. There is no Baal. He's not real. So they've been crying aloud to some being that does not even exist. They're crying aloud to something of their own imagination, to man's imagination, man's own invention. How foolish is this? So of course there's no answer, because there is no Baal. And this is what this is proving, that Baal does not exist. I mean, this is a very clear and loud testimony by his silence. It's loudly speaking that he doesn't exist, and that all the beliefs that they have about Baal and his prophets are all false, because this whole religion is foolishness, is falsehood. That's what this day has proven. And very quickly, it's going to be exposed now and proven that Jehovah is real, that he is God, and that Elijah is speaking truth, and he's speaking his word. Because of what's going to happen next, that we're going to have to wait for next week to read about. Well, you don't have to wait all the way to next week to read it. You can read it every day between now and next week, but together we will try to look at what happens next, next Sunday morning, Lord willing. But seeing as we're out of time, we'll ask. Oh, I'm so tempted to pick on the back row there again, but we'll let you off the hook this time. Brother Ted, would you lead us in prayer as we close?